And the good news is Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side by former White House Press Secretary Dana Perino, number one as of May 10th on the New York Times bestseller list, nonfiction and as an ebook.
Right.
You've conquered the print and the electronic world.
I attacked it from both angles.
Seven chapters and one more thing. And just like the five, we'll get to the one more thing at the end of this interview. But on a personal level first, Dana, who is Dana Perino and how did you get to the White House?
That's actually the question that was the reason I wrote the book, because I had this amazing experience as the White House press secretary. And I was the first Republican woman to have the job. And I get asked a lot, especially by younger people and younger women, how did you get that job? And I noticed that there's a couple of different ways to attack that. One, people mostly assume that you get a great job because you knew somebody. And while I think that making friends and networking has helped, I didn't know the Bushes. When I tell people I didn't grow up in Texas, I grew up in Wyoming, then they say, oh. And they assume that I knew the Cheneys and that the Cheneys got me my job. And what I wanted to do was to explain to people all across America, and especially younger people and their parents, that you don't have to have grown up in a fancy city and gone to an elite school and go to an Ivy League university in order to end up advising the President of the United States in the Oval Office. I grew up in a rural environment in eastern Wyoming and in a ranching family. Then I lived in Denver, Colorado, and my parents really took a lot of care with me, and in particular my dad, that started me on a journalism career. In the third grade, I had to start reading the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post every day before he got home from work, and I had to discuss two articles before dinner. And I write about how one time on Marine One, the president asked me a question, my opinion about something, and I told him what I thought. And I flashed back to being at the kitchen table with my dad and realized just how important that father-daughter time was for me later on. So it's a part memoir, part advice. I include very practical advice based on anecdotes that you could use today at the office, but over time in a career and in a life as well. And also give a little bit about getting along with people. I write a chapter called Civility Lost and Found. And I feel like I ended up with the book I intended to write.
Well, that is why you are here. And we're talking about your new book, And the Good News Is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side. I like that. Now, one of the bright sides about you is Jasper.
Yeah.
Jasper's in the book, and you've even made him a part of the five. So why Jasper?
Well, in case people don't know who Jasper is, he is America's dog. But not because I think he's the best dog in America. It's because one night on Red Eye, which is a show that Greg Gutfeld used to host on Red Eye, and now it continues as he works on a new program that he's going to launch soon. There was a segment about this Hollywood actress that had a little dog, and she got really mad at the paparazzi for taking pictures of her dog. And Gutfeld said, Dana, you've been known to fly into a rage when people take a photo of your dog. And I said, oh, quite the contrary. My dog can be everyone's dog. I want everyone to be able to share him, so he will be America's dog. And that's how the name started. And I have more fun with that dog. I've always had dogs. I grew up on the ranch and through my life. And Jasper actually came to be with us after my first dog passed away when we moved to New York. And that was really hard. But Greta Van Susteren of Fox had called me and said, the first thing you need to do is get another puppy. And I had 100 reasons why I shouldn't, especially because we lived on 46 floors up in the middle of Hell's Kitchen. We had just moved to New York, and that really wasn't conducive to raising a puppy. But the next day we decided we would get a dog, and there was Jasper.
He was arguably a press secretary to be modeled after, Tony Snow. Mm-hmm. And you followed him. What was it like working with him? Mm-hmm. And then to pick up that microphone after mm-hmm. Tony sadly passed away.
So Tony Snow inherited me as his deputy. I was already working in the press office for Scott McClellan, and then Scott McClellan was replaced by Tony Snow. And that was such an outside-the-box pick for the White House. He hadn't worked on the Bush campaign. He had worked for Bush 41 as a speechwriter. But then he'd gone on to have this big media career, and Josh Bolton, the chief of staff, convinced Tony to come to the White House and be the press secretary. And we got along great, and he gave me a ton of room to run. One of the things I do in the book is relate some advice, partly that I learned from him, which was he was not territorial about the job. So he didn't worry if he wasn't the one that was with the president all the time. In fact, he preferred for me to be the one who was with him all the time. So I did all the travel. I did all of the briefing before the press conferences. And Tony Snow focused on the podium work. And then we used to put him on talk radio all the time to just go out there and try to sell the
thing. He was a great radio guy. You got
to
say that about Tony as a
radio
guy.
And he loved to argue.
He loved to get in there and get in there.
And he would never get mad when he argued. I learned that from him, too. You know, you can disagree without being disagreeable, and you're more persuasive that way. So I was his deputy for a long time, and I remember the day that he was leaving the White House, he came into the office and he said, "How's it going?" And I said, "Well, not very good, because how am I supposed to replace you?" And he said, "Stand up." And so I did, and he was almost 6'5", and I'm 5 feet tall, and he put his hands on my shoulders, and he tilted my chin up and made sure I was making eye contact with him, and he shook me a little bit, and he said, "You are better at this than you think you are." And I sort of blew it off. I was like, "Oh, I'm so nervous." And I remember 2 weeks after that, it was a Friday night. I was cleaning up my desk. I had not started any world wars. The president wasn't mad at me. I was getting into the rhythm, and I realized, oh, that's what Tony meant, that I didn't have to try to be just like him, that I could be myself. And throughout the book, there's themes of men in my life that have helped me with really good advice because they wanted me to succeed. And I figured that they deserve some credit, and Tony Snow was one of them. The other story in the book that people didn't know, including Ed Henry, did not know this. Ed Henry was the CNN reporter at the time in the briefing room. And Tony had left the White House and was trying to take care of his health and also just to, you know, have some time in the private sector. And he collapsed during a speaking trip out to Spokane, Washington. And he was been in the hospital for several weeks. We were monitoring it. I kept in touch with his wife, Jill, a lot. And then we had to go to Japan for the G8. So we go to Japan. I am exhausted. We get home. I tell my husband, I just need one day to recuperate. So I got to bed late, and my phone rang at 6 in the morning. And I looked at the phone. It said CNN, Ed Henry, which is unusual, right, that time of morning. So I answer the phone, and it's Ed, and he's sad. And he said, "Dana, I'm so sorry, but I need to get comment from the White House." And he didn't say what the topic was, but I knew that Tony had died. But I didn't want CNN to be able to say CNN informed the White House about its own press secretary passing away. So thankfully, I had quick reflexes, and I said, "I'll call you right back." And I started scrolling through my email, and around, I think it was 4 a.m., I had received an email from Tony Snow's wife, Jill, and that he had passed. Well, let me tell you some good news about the Tony Snow family for people that loved him. You know, he left behind his wife and then three children, and they were like 16, 14, and 12. And this year, in 2 weeks, Kendall, his oldest, will graduate from the Savannah College of Art and Design. Robbie, who apparently is just like Tony Snow, is at Clemson. And Christy is graduating from high school and has a bright future ahead of her as well. So he set them up for success, and Jill's done a great job in carrying it through.
What was it like to pick up the microphone after Tony?
Well, because I had been in an acting role for him for so long that I didn't really have a lot of time to worry about it. In fact, one of the things I write about in the book is that I take the job, and nobody knows that behind the scenes, I'm having to plan a secret trip to Iraq. And only a handful of people in the White House could know that it was happening. And I couldn't delegate to anybody because there were so many ways that it could leak. So we had a very close hold. So I was so busy that I didn't really have time to think about what was happening.
Let's talk about the relationship between the press corps. You're now at the podium on a daily basis. You're traveling with the president. What was the relationship like with the White House press corps in the Bush years, and contrast that with what you observe now in the Obama years?
Well, the press and the press secretary have a naturally adversarial relationship, but it wasn't aggressively angry, except for on occasion. There's no secret that the Bush administration had some tough press days, partly because we had some bad facts sometimes, or just challenges. And I always felt like we had a really good professional relationship with the press. Partly that was just my nature, and that was also what the president expected. So we had to carry that out. I made sure that every reporter always got a return phone call. my office was the most polite. And I would, if you did a blind call to any of the reporters that were in the briefing room when I was running the press office, I promise you they will tell you that we were responsive and polite and helpful. And I never burned a reporter. If I had somebody come to my office and maybe they were on the cusp of breaking some big news, I never went around them. I always made sure that they got a chance to break that news because I had been a journalist too, so I knew
so
what that was like.
So you understood that yeah. relationship and how important it was on the other side.
Yeah, I did. And also, a lot of those reporters I had been working with for several years because I'd been in the White House for so long. So I knew them. I knew their families. And another thing is I read everything that they wrote. And I would compliment them or not. And I also had a rule for myself that before I picked up the phone to complain to a reporter, I always read the article twice. And I have found, that's actually advice that I got when I worked on Capitol Hill. On second read, it's usually not as bad as you thought.
Your first reaction, mm-hmm. of course. You know, you mentioned President Bush and the relationship he wanted. Do you think President Obama wants a different relationship today with the press?
I think President Obama feels like he wins if he's fighting all the time. And sometimes I wonder, why are they fighting? The press is for them. They actually have had it very easy. One of the things I advise for the private sector is that if you want to hire a communications person that's battle-tested, don't hire someone that worked in a Democratic White House. They had it easy. Try a Republican White House. That's where it's actually the real skill and battle testing takes place. I do think that the White House has pushed the White House press corps to the back of the room so much that now the White House press corps is frustrated. They used to call me and say, complain, you know, about how they were treated by the Obama White House. And I said, well, you guys, you are ceding ground. And if the people cede ground to the government, it's very hard to get it back. And with the new technology and the different ways of being able to communicate now, that's only going to continue to be a challenge, though I think that things are getting a little bit better on that front.
Given all of what you've just said, your take on media today, what is the state of media?
I'm excited for it, okay? So I love all the different competition. I think that things have improved over time. With technology, that wasn't necessarily the case when the internet was first really taken off and the news organizations wanted to be first. It was sort of shoot first, ask questions later. I actually don't think that's the case anymore, and I'll tell you one of the reasons why. Conservatives are excellent at social media. They weren't necessarily in the 2008 campaign.
Not typically what's thought of, but...
Well, not in the 2008 campaign in terms of getting voters out, but on the media side of things, they're very good, they're clever, they're funny, and they are factually based. So I think that the peer pressure to get things right, because let's face it, most reporters write for each other. Okay, that's their audience, that's their peer group, that's their competition. So if they get something wrong, the tidal wave of ridicule is so big and powerful that I actually think people are taking a little bit more care before they post articles now. I think that's a good thing.
Well, instead of being first, be correct.
And there's so many other places, too. For example, I love the Breitbart site. I like the Daily Signal. I like National Review, Weekly Standard. I love Kevin Williamson at National Review. I mean, he's one of the best writers of our time, by far. He had a line the other day about Ulysses S. Grant that just made me laugh out loud when I was on the airplane. And I feel like the conservatives have really stepped it up, and the libertarians, too. And you know what? I have fun on social media. I really like it, and I learn a ton from people.
Well, just keep Jasper out there, by
I will,
the way.
Because I'm sure that I don't think that anybody else would say they learn a lot from me, except for about my dog.
Well, I've learned a lot from you, just for the record. The book is, and the good news is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side by former White House Press Secretary Dana Perino. Let's go to the years in the Bush administration and where we are now. These are tumultuous times. Foreign policy, national security, and home and abroad really matters. You were mm-hmm. in the White House during some of those most tumultuous times, and that's in recent, not only American, but in world history. So What actions specifically do you feel that President Obama took and his administration took that destroyed what the Bush team built and accomplished in Iraq?
Okay, well, in Iraq specifically, President Obama campaigned on a plan to withdraw from Iraq. There was actually a plan in the Bush administration to do so gradually, and after success had been solidified. The Iraq that President Obama inherited is not the Iraq he would have inherited even the year before. What President Bush and David Petraeus were able to do with the surge, I should say they didn't do it, obviously our troops did it, but in making that courageous decision to send more troops and to change the mission, they actually turned things around to the point that President Obama thought it was okay to leave, and he was desperate to do so. And I think that there's that one, which meant that the Iraqis felt like they were being abandoned, and they knew that they were vulnerable to that, and that allowed Iran to come in and cause even more problems. At the same time, I actually think that you have to, it's hard to just segment it into just Iraq or just Afghanistan. What President Obama basically said is America's coming home. And that day that President Obama did not enforce his red line in Syria, I know a former national security person from the Bush administration who said, this is the day that wrecked the world. And I think back to that, it's almost 3 years ago now. And some of the things that she said would happen over time. And 3 years later, that is what we are dealing with.
You mentioned Afghanistan. And of course, during the campaign in 2007, President Obama called it the just war or the right war, or something to that effect. Given the disaster in some ways that Afghanistan has become, do you feel that in the Bush years that should have been made more of a priority?
I was actually just looking at Decision Points, which was President Bush's book. I had to reread a couple of things in there to refresh my memory on something. And I think at the time, given the trajectory, I don't know if anything could have been done differently at that particular time, given the information available. Of course, looking back is always a little bit different. Here's some good news, I think, in Afghanistan now. Even though I think we are leaving too early, I think the military that is on the ground there, our military, is having some success in getting President Obama to change his mind on that. And I think what President Obama does respect is the new president of Afghanistan is a better guy than Karzai. And he came to Washington, and what was the first thing he said at the press conference? He said, thank you, America, for your investment. You know what? Americans thought, wow, no one has thanked us. No other government has thanked us.
He went to the people, not just to the leadership.
He didn't just say thank you to President Obama. He said, I'm going to speak directly to the American citizens whose taxpayer dollars have basically tried to give my country another chance. And I thought that that was really good. So I actually hear some fairly, I don't know, like it's not good news out of Afghanistan, but I do think that new governance is probably a little bit more helpful than we think. And we should continue to support him.
More into the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. Do you think that during the Bush years, we got a straightforward analysis and a truthful explanation about Saudi Arabia and their involvement in the spread of some elements of radical Islam?
I would say that nobody was, that there was full awareness. That doesn't necessarily mean we got the straight story directly. Okay, but I do think that our intelligence, that we were well aware and that we were able to try to work as best we could with them, certain elements of them, in order to prevent additional problems. In the 1990s, when our military and our intelligence budgets were stripped down, and that had to be re-upped after 9/11, I think that the president recognized, and especially this is true with Iran, America pays a price for not keeping intelligence resources fully supplied.
In the list of all the problems facing us here in the United States, where would you rank, again, given how the Obama administration approaches it, where would you rank radical Islamic terrorism?
I think it's high, but I'll tell you what is more interesting to me. I just talked to a pollster the other day that does nationwide polling with it's a Republican and a Democrat team. And he said their recent poll showed a number that he was so surprised because the question is, do you worry that you or your family at some point will be the victim of a terrorist attack in America? And right after 9/11, that number was about 65% in major cities amongst men, and about that with women all across the country, no matter where you went, lived, grew up, even if it was like my hometown of Newcastle, Wyoming. Women were worried, okay? That abated a little bit towards the end of the 2000 decade. You know, 2006 to 2010, people felt a little bit more comfortable. Then, in the last year, that number is back up to 72%, both men and women, all across the country, not just in major cities. So, regardless of what I think, the country is very concerned about the spread of it. And, you know, you asked me specifically what President Obama's decisions had done in Iraq. I actually think that first move to stop the global war on terror was a bad one. Because if you look at the terrorist attacks that we've had just in recent memory, I could list them all, pretty soon you realize, oh, it's happening all around the world. We are in a global war on terror. I know he didn't want to call it that, but for all intents and purposes, that's what it is.
The reality is what it is, regardless of the naming of it. However, the policies do matter. And right now, we have a field that is growing, Dana, a field of Republican candidates. We have Rand Paul, Senator Paul, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Ted Cruz. We are awaiting Jeb Bush's decision, Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Scott Walker,
Huckabee,
Governor
Santorum.
Christie. Yes, yeah, so the list goes on. And it is a wide field.
Yeah.
But given national security and its importance right now in foreign policy, do you feel any of those candidates have real national security chops?
This is what I learned, that no one has enough national security experience before they enter the Oval Office. You actually really kind of get it on day one. And that's true for any of them. I think Hillary Clinton could make an argument that she understands a lot of the geopolitics around the world more. I don't think that necessarily translates into being able to protect America more, but that's going to be a challenge for Republicans. And I think the 2016 field for Republicans is stronger than 2012. There's a lot of diversity, a lot of experience, and there's real choices to be made. And right now, we're just at the beginning of this marathon, so everybody's just left the starting gate and they're elbowing each other so they
can
try to get to the front.
Some haven't even left the starting gate.
Some of them got stuck way in the back because their early time wasn't very good. But remember, in 2008, at this point in the election, it was conventional wisdom that Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani would be the nominees. And that's not who it turned out to be. So anytime I hear a profession of it's going to be this or that, I just take it with a grain of salt because it's just way too early to tell. But we're only 3 months away from the first Republican debate.
It'll be a long, hot summer politically. It's not just baseball. I'm a baseball fan. But a long, hot political summer. The book is, and the good news is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side by former White House Press Secretary and my colleague at Fox News, Dana Perino, by 7 chapters and one more thing.
Now, isn't that cute?
When
you saw that, did you say, oh, that's cute?
I chuckled. I chuckled out loud. Actually, I laughed out loud because one more thing is also a part of the 5. And you've talked openly about the relationship, and I've had the good fortune sometimes to be on the 5. With Greg, you call him a little brother.
He is little. Just kidding, Greg. I call him the brother I never wanted, but I adore him. I love my show. I love the people on my show. I can't believe I get to do it. Sometimes I think, wow, you get paid to think things through all day and talk about issues and then come on here and make a point but also have fun. It's just amazing. I love it. I love our fans. I've been out on book tour a little bit, and I can't believe the number of people that stand in line to actually get a signature from me and get a quick picture with me. And how many of them love the 5? They say they make sure they're always home when it's on, or they record it and they watch it every night. Sometimes whole families are watching it together. And it's just, you've been on the show. I mean, it's It's fast-paced. We talk about serious issues, but we don't take ourselves too seriously.
I like that. And now, one more thing.
Okay. I get anything?
You get anything you want. It's the Dana Perino.
Okay, good.
One more thing.
Did you know that I actually, one more thing was originated with my idea, but it was supposed to be something else. And Greg was going to call it Scraps. But what I really wanted was time at the end of the show to be able to go back to things that had been said on the show and correct them, usually something Bob Beckel had said. But I think Porter Berry, our producer, had a better idea. When people come through the line, especially young people, they say they love the five. So what's your favorite part? One more thing is their favorite. What I write in this book, my one more thing, is my 1,200-word take on why I am a conservative and how that ideology informs my principles and is my worldview. And I feel like it's a justification for basically where I came from and how I try to manage my life. One of the things also I tried to do with the book was, if you see the cover and the title, it's a book that says, you know, there are Republican women that you could be friends with too. We're friendly. You know,
well,
we have
even
a, we're
the picture
cheerful.
On the front of the book is
yeah.
a friendly.
We're friendly
way,
and we're cheerful.
The quintessential Dana Perino look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I realized? This is probably the only book I'm ever going to write. And I knew I was going to look at it for the rest of my life. I thought I better like that picture.
Well, it's a great picture. The good news is we were able to do this, and I looked forward to it. I'm so glad we got to do it for the Patriot audience. The book is, and the good news is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side by former White House Press Secretary Dana Perino. Now, on May 10th, this will be New York Times number one on the bestseller nonfiction, and number one as an ebook. You've conquered both worlds.
Can you believe it?